These days, most of us communicate with each other through short electronic bursts, text messages, and email. My guests today spent a year corresponding with each other in the form of prose poetry. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Poet Marvin Bell and Christopher Merrill, the director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program, wrote letters to each other in the form of poetry. Merrill's were written as he traveled around the world, and Bell's were written from the United States. They both explored some of the same themes: life, death, love, war, and memory. Today, I'll talk with them about their collaboration, Everything at Once. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Between them, former Iowa Poet Laureate Marvin Bell and director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program Christopher Merrill have published almost more books than I can count. Their latest publication is a joint venture called Everything at Once. It's a collection of poems that came out of an unusual correspondence. For a year, they wrote to each other in the form of prose poetry. Marvin Bell, thank you for being here.
Good morning.
And Christopher Merrill, thank you for coming back.
Nice to see you, Charity.
So where did this idea come from?
Well, I guess I'll answer that because the idea came from Marvin. Long ago, he and the late William Stafford wrote just a wonderful book, dialogue called Segways, a book that I cherished. And then some years later, I translated a book by the French surrealist poets André Breton, René Char, and Paul Éluard. They wrote a book together over a week. And I love that idea of collaboration. And so over the years, Marvin and I kicked around the idea of this. And a few years ago, for the 40th anniversary of the International Writing Program, we put together a book over the course of 4 days. Seven poets from five countries composed a book together. And when it was done, Marvin said, "That was so much fun. Let's do something else." And we kept kicking the idea around until finally at lunch one day about a year and a half ago, I think we sort of looked at each other and said, we're not getting any younger, and we better start this soon. So eventually we agreed to write it in one paragraph a piece to give us a chance to explore all the possibilities of prose poetry, of meditations, reflections. And eventually I wrote one. I sent it off to Marvin, and he replied, and off we were. Off we were running.
Did you also correspond in other ways at the same time, or did you communicate only through these poems?
Oh, I would say our emails were cryptic, right? they were very short. And we had lunch from time to time. And did we talk on the phone? I don't think we talked on the phone.
Not much.
Just cryptic emails.
But Chris is all over the world all the time, so the only way to reach him is email.
So did you plan things out? Did you say, you know, let's do a few on a certain theme, or was this entirely non-scripted in advance?
Oh, non-scripted for sure. Basically, each of us, I think, would look at what had just come from the other and try to create a link by some free association. Sometimes the link was narrative, you know, the story went on, or it was a parallel story. We began with fairly personal things, but it very soon turned sociopolitical and took up aesthetic matters, and Chris had a lot of stories.
Well, I always thought that a couple of times I had little bits and pieces of things in reserve, which I thought, oh, I can write this one. And then what Marvin, I'll use this and I'll be able to get ahead. But then Marvin would send in his we would call them paras, his paragraph, and it would send me in a completely different direction. So that was really the fun of it, is not knowing where you were going to go from poem to poem.
And did you have a way of responding? Did you make a rule for yourself that you had to respond in a certain period of time or compose in a certain way?
well, we were usually quick about it. Occasionally there'd be a delay. I experienced more delays than Chris did, which is absolutely amazing because he was sending his from all over the world. He was very busy.
But this is how memory works, because I'm fairly certain that I was the one who was always late. But well, you know, a lot of the times when one or the other was late, it seemed to signal some kind of a turn in the way that the series was developing, and maybe the slowness of reply was not just a function of our travel schedules, but of taking in something that led us into new territory.
That's a good point. That's true.
And when you compiled them in the end, did you use everything that you did in the time that you corresponded?
Oh yeah, yeah. These are the 60 we wrote.
You can't go back, because if you've written your paragraph in response somehow to the previous paragraph, well, then he's going to link to that. And it's a chain. You can't take a link out.
Well, you guys were making up all the rules, so I don't know.
I can say one rule was we started with this idea of the one paragraph. And then one of the pieces that Marvin wrote triggered something for me that ended up being bigger than the other paragraphs. And we figured it would go – Marvin pointed out that it would go over a page. And so in effect, I had to go back and start over. And that – which was the right thing, because that was material for something else. And so I went back and started over, and off we went again.
You each referred to events that took place in your own lives while you were writing these things, although you referred to them in a cryptic way. For example, even right at the opening of the book, you write about an event where there was a child that captured the attention of the crowd, even though they were supposed to be listening to a speaker. Marvin, did you know where he was? Did you have any of the extra information that I, as a reader, wouldn't have?
I think it wasn't necessary to have it, but I did have extra information just because Chris and I have known each other a long time, and I knew where his emails were coming from. I knew what he was doing, you know, that sort of thing.
Maybe you guys could give us a sample of what you did. And since Tropical Storm Sandy is bearing down on the East Coast, you selected a part that is involves a storm, right?
Yeah. Well, actually, we'll read two apiece, and one of which brings us to that storm, okay? So I've got this one that I wrote, I now realize, in Montana, and it's called The Lake. At daybreak, wrapped in a blanket on the porch of a cabin by a lake, I look up from a history of the 20th century to see mist hanging above the calm water, the bands of green, cedar and fir and spruce that define the mountain blocking the sun, an osprey nest crowning a lodgepole pine on the far shore like the knob of a walking stick, no wind, only the stream trickling into the lake, and then the sounds I am learning to distinguish here. The hum of a dragonfly, the splash of a trout leaping near the dock, the whistle of the train bound for whitefish. From the sealed freight cars, families were separated into lines of men, women, and children, then stripped, shaved, their hair was used as stuffing for mattresses and wigs for dolls, and led to the showers, sometimes to the accompaniment of women prisoners singing arias from the railroad platform. Now a woodpecker needles a tree by the portage to the next lake. And from the bunk bed inside the cabin comes the sighing of my older daughter as she shifts in sleep. Now the nest under the eaves spring to life, the chirping of three chicks eager for the worm brought by a robin that alit above me as I read about the women raising their arms so that their children could fit into the shower with them. The mouths of the chicks will remain open after the robin flies off.
You can see how we were turning sociopolitical, too. And mine was called Staircase, and there is a personal event behind it, but how I linked up I no longer remember. One can't link up just from the personal event, of course. This is called Staircase. If one had never fallen down a flight of stairs, perhaps there might have remained, and I say this with a smile, might have remained a sense of the stairway as an abstraction, a roadway in the air, a corridor too advanced for walls, in a society in which one could be forever safe while acting naturally. One's first thoughts would still encompass all of the present moment instead of the infinite number of traces, nuances, hints, flickers, flitterings, and floaters impinging on one's mind from other days and places, some of which may have long since ceased to exist. Such are we who feather our landings with a last grasp at what is not there. In this way, the current of one's sensory awareness slows down as a collision of any sort begins to approach. A few seconds will take a long time during a smash-up. By long and short divisions of time, we make of the continuum of our lives, not to mention the neural pathways of thought, paths befitting the corkscrew, the chambered nautilus, fictive Klein bottles, and traversable wormholes. Using the half-step and the stutter step, the pause and suspension, we choose where to place a foot and another. So it proceeds, a presence lost to entropy, as the wind flattens our footprints, the tide washes them away. And we learn, as we hurtle, spinning from the landing to the floor, that the way we came is not the way back. The apparitions of truth are forever bound to the fears of a parent. Try not to think of what you wish to remember.
And I'm sure, I know that I remember when that poem came, the image of the staircase. And I the extra information Marvin talks about, I knew about Marvin blowing out his knee years ago, falling down a staircase. So that part is rattling around somewhere in my imagination. But also in my memory is the fact that as a child, our family house was washed out to sea in the same kind of storm that's hurtling down on the East Coast right now. So that haunts my imagination. And when I take Marvin's staircase and then the question of what you wish to remember, that seemed to lead to this, which is called Breach. Half of the stairway vanished in the storm surge, which flooded the barrier island, freed a fleet of fishing vessels, and gave rise to a new political class defined by its singular inability to govern. It took months for repairs to begin on the drawbridge. No one could agree on a plan to reopen the lighthouse, and the sand accumulating in the inlet, the result of a hasty decision to close down all dredging operations, brought an end to shipping. The merchants were preparing to take matters into their own hands when funds to protect the sea turtles dried up. Soon a pit lined with broken eggs appeared on the beach among heaps of sea wrack and driftwood, buoys and crab traps. And then the tourists returned. On their first morning, the children ran down the boardwalk from the rented house to what remained of the wooden stairway. And there they found only air. They stood on the last step, astonished, daring each other to jump into the dunes. He had a red badge pinned to his bathing suit. She wore a white hat and blue sundress. Below them were patches of sea oats, holes into which to chase ghost crabs, timber and masts from shipwrecks. Wild horses galloped along the beach, which was not as wide as they remembered, and they had never heard such a clattering of waves breaking over the ribbons of shells along the shore. A dolphin breached the glittering sea. The boy turned to the girl. One, two, three.
And we need to take a break, Marvin, so we'll get back to your part in a little while. I'm talking today with former Iowa Poet Laureate Marvin Bell and Christopher Merrill, who's director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program. We're talking about their recent collaboration called Everything at Once. It's a collection of poems that came out of a correspondence over the period of a year. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and my guests today are Christopher Merrill. He is the director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program, and Marvin Bell, former Iowa Poet Laureate. Their latest publication is a joint venture called Everything at Once. And just before the break, they were reading to us one of the exchanges from that book. And Marvin, I have a question for you. Because a lot of your contributions to the book, and actually both of you, but more of yours, played on the idea of memory and the fact that memory isn't always entirely what it seems to be. Like you wrote one of your passages about Joe Elephant. You dreamt about a man that you knew named Joe Elephant, and it gave you such a warm feeling to have visited with him. And then by the end of the passage, we realized you never knew a Joe Elephant.
No, I never did. I did figure out who he stood for in the dream, a fellow named Arnold DiCarlo, in fact. Well, if I talk about memory a bit, I suppose it's because I'm a geezer. You know, that's our job.
But it was... I loved that one in particular because I've had those experiences. I'm not quite a geezer yet, but I've had those experiences where I've had a dream about someone who has died, and I've woken up with such a warm feeling as if I've just had, you know, breakfast or lunch with my grandpa, that kind of thing. And it was that carried me right to that sort of feeling. And you seem to enjoy plumbing memory for a lot of these.
I suppose I do. One of the differences between Chris and me in this series is that he's all over the world and he has narrative and his memories go back in history to, important people from important times. Well, I'm here in Iowa City. I live in three places in the country, but they're all in this country. And so I naturally, I think also it's my predilection in poetry, I naturally perhaps mix more abstractions, whereas he is far stronger on narrative.
Well, I think you did a little bit of both, though, Christopher, throughout the book. There are certainly narratives, but there are also abstractions as well.
Yeah, but I don't have... Marvin's got a very rigorous philosophical grounding, and mine is not as rigorous. So I tended to shy away from that sort of move. Although I think that in the series, Marvin was coaxing it out of me in some of the poems. But I was just thinking of this poem of Marvin's called "Code," which really goes right to the heart of memory.
Would you read it?
Oh, sure. "Code" here refers to. International Morse code. I used to be an amateur radio operator when I was a kid. So this is called "Code." In a small town, everything is elsewhere. My memory of radio remains lodged in Morse code. That's how we went from here to there in those days. Roy's ham radio shack was his attic. Herb's was his backyard repair shop. Van's was a one-room house in the woods where he built transmitters only to see if they worked, one after another. The smell of solder glued the walls, and a dozen dials glowed to measure space. Memory, like the fabled primordial ooze, lies shapeless at a murky depth. It may emerge in the form of a boy's 20-watt call to the far world. It may live again as a whiff of smoke or solder, or as a song at highway speed. And it may hold a kind of code. My memories go their own way. Some are too personal for words. Some are just dry storage. But oh my, the ones that still matter. If one can crack the code and read between the lines. The old telegraph operators could copy behind and would let the Morse message run on ahead while they packed a pipe or retied their shoes. Just so, the years run on ahead, but memory catches up. Morse code has been phased out, like muscle memory over time. It was years before I knew that Dorothy puts herself to sleep by silently reciting poems, state capitals, the 99 counties of Iowa. Yet she has tried to learn International Morse code and cannot, so she says. I suggested she learn the dots and dashes for the day when I might have a stroke and be able to blink my eyes in code. I think this reason has something to do with her not being able to learn Morse code. Love is the child who closes her eyes to make things go away and to relive the past. I heard three times from St. Pierre and McQuillan Islands.
Marvin Bell reading from the new collection, Everything at Once, which is not yet out. When is it coming out?
Good question.
Okay.
We haven't really sent it to a publisher yet, and we'll see what happens.
I think in some ways we're a little stunned that we're done. That was because it came to a moment where suddenly it was finished. That was, on the one hand, a cause for celebration, but on the other hand, noting something had come to an end. And so for me, I know I've been kind of thinking, well, gee, are we really done? Are you sure we're done?
No, we're not.
This was clearly a great deal of fun for the two of you. What do you think readers are going to take away from it once they get their hands on it?
Wow, that's a hard one, isn't it? Let's see. Well, it could go like this. I wasn't home the other day when a phone call came from me from someone. And so Dorothy wrote out the message to me. And the person had twice said that I was amazing and brilliant. And I have kept that piece of paper around. Every once in a while, I pick it up and say, oh, here's something. And I read from it to Dorothy. Maybe the readers will send us notes like that.
You know, I can say after our reading... at Prairie Lights the other night, we have a writer here from Zimbabwe, Christopher Malauzi, who told me the next day that he and his best friend had decided to start on a joint venture. And what they had done was to draw up a list of 30 things that they have in common in Zimbabwe. And that might be a hill, a lake, a river, different kinds of animals. And each one is going to write a page about each of those different things. So it won't be a back and forth in the way that we have engaged, but it will be a different kind of conversation. And I think that's what the book we did, Seven Poets, 4 Days, One Book, which was so much fun. It seems to me people use it in courses now, and it gives them ideas for ways to collaborate. And ideally, the readers will take our books and go and make their own collaborations.
This is something anyone can do. We said that in the introduction to the book Bill Stafford and I did. Anyone can do this. You know, you could start up with a friend or two friends and go back and forth. Collaboration is so interesting. Not only do you feed off the other person, but your ego doesn't. It shouldn't get in the way. Put it that way. You have to, you know, you have to blend the egos after all. And that's a good thing, too, I think. We're all in this together. And collaboration proves it.
And does it make you stretch yourself in different ways to work with someone else like that?
Oh, without a doubt. When you mentioned the question about philosophy, Marvin has a series of poems called Aesthetic Wobble 1, Aesthetic Wobble 2, each of which raises important aesthetic questions. And in my ordinary run of reading and writing, those are questions I would not have probably entertained. But because they were coming via email, I'd read them and I knew that would be informing whatever I wrote next. So that's the give and take that's so much fun.
Before we leave this subject and leave the subject of memory, which we talked about briefly, I want to read an email from Cheryl in Cedar Rapids, and this is for you, Marvin. My daughter, Hannah, discovered Marvin Bell's poetry while in high school. She was a huge fan. She attended the University of Iowa as a member of the Iowa Writers Learners Community in fall of 2005, and one of the highlights of that experience was meeting Marvin Bell in person. She died in a car accident 2.5 years ago today. Her friends posted parts of To Dorothy on her Facebook wall. That poem will now always have special meaning for me, and she had so much potential as a writer. Her loss is a loss to the literary community. So I just wanted to share that with you, Marvin.
Oh, thank you. It's very moving.
And Christopher, I want to ask you, because you are balancing writing these poems and traveling around the world and your work with writers from countries all over the world, but also that puts you in to the world of politics at the same time. Do you feel pulled in many different directions? I can't think of anything less poetic often than politics. Mm-hmm. So how do you cope with that pull?
Yeah. Well, I do have to travel a lot, and it's often to places that, as the State Department likes to refer to them, of strategic interest. So they are complicated places. And I always make notes wherever I travel. While we were doing this collaboration, I found that I was making notes differently. I was, on some level, seeing the world differently. When I traveled to Afghanistan for the first time and made notes before we had begun the series, they were the notes, if you will, of a nonfiction writer. That's one part of my life, thinking that at some point this might be turned into a work of nonfiction. The second time I traveled there, I did make some notes as a nonfiction writer, but more to the point, I was thinking, gee, you know, I just got this poem from Marvin. I wonder if anything here will come of that might be worked into a poem. And that was the case in different places. When I was, Marvin wrote a poem about 9/11. And as it happened on 9/11, I started the day in Montevideo, Uruguay, and then flew through Santiago, Chile to Lima, Peru, on to La Paz, Bolivia. And I thought, oh, that will make a pretty interesting way to think about 9/11, because I was in Santiago, Chile, where 30 years before, on 9/11, there had been, you know, huge demonstrations. It was another revolution. So it gave me occasion to try to think about those things. Writing about politics is really complicated. I mean, it can quickly get tendentious. You're playing with fire there.
Do you ever feel like you're being torn in half?
In half?
trying to balance these two different sides of what you do.
I'd say only every 15 seconds of the day.
Chris has even more bows than to his instrument than he's letting on. I mean, this is a man who actually wrote a book about the first U.S. soccer team to participate in the World Cup. He's written a spiritual memoir called The Tree of Doves, which is just utterly amazing.
Yes, we talked about that on this show.
Oh, you know about that, yeah. And, I mean, nonfiction, investigative journalism, he does it all.
Well, and speaking of that, you have a piece published in the Huffington Post, on the Huffington Post today, mm-hmm. in collaboration with a number of others called Doubling Down on Democracy. So this is your diplomatic side. Mm-hmm. And you're writing about the attacks this year on the 11th anniversary of September 11th. Can you tell us what prompted you to write this article and what is your message?
This piece, Doubling Down on Diplomacy, came out of that idea that very quickly the attack in Benghazi was turned into a political football. And because I spend a lot of time working with diplomats, I've just returned from Baghdad, where I was with a lot of brave diplomats who go out every day in the same way that our ambassador did in Benghazi. And they try to do what we do in the International Writing Program, which is to make contact with people, to exchange ideas and information, to just to be normal human beings. And it seemed to me that some of the kinds of arguments you heard in the wake of Benghazi were those same arguments that force us to retreat into the Fortress America mentality.
Well, then it's not the way diplomacy has always been done. There have been many decades, in fact, where diplomats in other countries don't have that much contact with the people those countries.
Yeah, but we're at our best, I think, when we have that contact, when people get to find out who we are. When I was in Baghdad last week, I was meeting with writers, I was meeting with students, I was meeting at universities and in different places, and everywhere I heard the same thing was, oh, yes, we know all about the American military, but we want to find out about American poetry and American music and American film, and what does an average American think about? And I think that when we have that chance to lob ideas back and forth in the way that Marvin and I were doing in this book, we show off our better sides of ourselves, our nobler sides, and also the sides of us that are more real. And so my colleagues from this task force on cultural diplomacy got together to write this piece to remind us that although there are voices out there calling for war in various quarters and wishing to make political hay out of what happened, the tragedy in Benghazi, there are other ways to do business that generally involve a lot less loss of blood and a lot less loss of treasure.
Well, and you point out that Ambassador Chris Stevens was in Benghazi because he was reviewing plans for a new cultural center.
Exactly. And you know, I can't tell you how many places I've been around the country, around the world, where somebody's gone into what used to be an American library, now is an American Corners, or the cultural center that Ambassador Stevens was opening, and they find a book by an American, and then they read it, and it changes their lives. I was in Burma about 10 years ago, and I met a couple of young poets, and I asked one of them what he was working on, and he said, "I just translated John Ashbery's Some Trees." It's his first book of poems, and I thought, where did he ever get a hold of a copy of Some Trees, which is a pretty wild book? And then I thought, I wonder how this went over in Burma. And he said they loved it. And our Burmese poet here this year just said to me, you know, we have a lot of people who like John Ashbery and Charles Bernstein and all the language poets. And I thought, how bizarre. But that's kind of how cultural diplomacy, that's how culture works. It works in subterranean ways, people exchanging ideas. I love this poem. Look at this book. Have you heard this piece of music? New things get created. Different way of looking at the world becomes apparent.
Do you think that as the world has changed, of course, it's impossible to stop the flow of information because of the internet and because of smartphones and things like that. And although there are countries that have tried very hard to control that flow of information, it really is almost impossible. Do you think that that makes it even more important to try to spread other kinds of culture around as so much of what can be passed electronically is not poetry, is not literature?
Well, it's funny. When I covered the war in Yugoslavia in the 90s, there was no internet, really. And in fact, the only way you could call out from Sarajevo was on a satellite phone at the cost of $45 a minute. So in effect, in that war, I had very little contact with the outside world. Now I could be in Baghdad and flip on the TV or the internet or my smartphone and be in touch with everybody. And now that we're in touch with everybody, that can enforce one way of looking at things. But again, it's that people-to-people contact. What Ambassador Stevens was doing when he walked around Benghazi, and that was the case when he walked around Tripoli, he was saying to the Libyans in this new fermenting society, you know, we're not afraid. We'll take some risks. We'll take some chances. But we're going to reach out to you. We're going to see if we can't make contact.
I'm talking with Christopher Merrill. He is the director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program, and Marvin Bell, former Iowa Poet Laureate. Their most recent book is a collaboration with each other. It's called Everything at Once. We've been talking about that and many other things, and we'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe, and with me today, former Iowa Poet Laureate Marvin Bell and Christopher Merrill, director of the University of Iowa International Writing Program. They are publishing a book together, although they don't have a date for its release yet, called Everything at Once. It's a collection of poems that came about through a year-long correspondence between the two of them as Christopher Merrill traveled around the world and Marvin Bell around the United States. As you mentioned, Marvin, you live in three different places in the United States. And you, the reason we're talking about this today is you're just about to leave Iowa, right?
We were going to leave tomorrow for what is annually a two-month stay in a borrowed house on eastern Long Island. But guess what? We've delayed it.
It's a damp place right now.
Yes, it is. I'm set in New York City, and he's well prepared for this, but that doesn't keep Dad from sending him messages.
And your advice to him?
Oh, don't use the elevator. He's on the 26th floor. Stay away from the windows. Like that.
And how does he take that advice from
Well,
you?
This may sound strange to you, but I have a son who's a ninja. That is, he's not a cartoon ninja. He's not, you know, a ninja from the movies. He's an actual ninja. He's not a very big guy, and he doesn't want to be known for it anymore, so he doesn't even teach seminars anymore in it. But he served in the security contingent for the Dalai Lama when the Dalai Lama was in New York. He's an actual ninja. So the whole idea of being a ninja is that you see everything coming and you're well prepared. But so, this doesn't keep Dad from telling him things.
I suppose that's another one of the beauties of the electronic age is that he can ignore it and you don't know. So I'm curious, though, for you, I mean, in so much of your poetry and in this book, again, you wrote about memory, but also both of you wrote about home in some ways. And for you, Marvin, living in three different places around the country, how has that changed your idea of home?
Well, I know this country very well because we've lived in a great many other places, too, on sabbatical or when I took temporary teaching jobs or short-term teaching jobs and so forth. And we've lived abroad, too. And I have a pretty good sense of what this country is. And among other things, I think I have an understanding of why people in a number of Western states and Midwestern states think very differently about politics and about the government than my friends on the East Coast do. We live in Sag Harbor, New York, for 2 months in the winter. We live in Iowa City pretty much in October. We're out of town. And then from January to June, which much amuses our friends elsewhere since it's the winter here. And then we spend what is now 4 months a year in Port Townsend, Washington, way up in the Northwest. Our friends in Port Townsend used to say, oh, when you retire, you can come and stay here. We never had the nerve to tell them, no, we never would because, you know, in Iowa in the winter, the sun shines. But I think I do have a sense of the country. You know, I've lived in When I was in the Army, I lived in Indianapolis. I lived in rural Vermont. I lived in Santa Cruz and San Francisco and Santa Fe, just to get the Santas out of the way, you know. We've lived in Chicago. I've lived in three places in upstate New York. We've lived in two places in Spain. We lived in Mexico, et cetera. So I have a sense of how different the different parts of this country are. You know, our friends in the East think that the West Coast is kind of zany and the Midwest is a great wasteland. And our friends in the Northwest think that the East Coast is sort of corrupt and dangerous and the Midwest is a great wasteland. We try to tell them.
Right, right. I guess it's something you have to learn for yourself, right? Christopher, as you travel around the world, of course, this is home to you now, but how does that change your ideas? You're traveling so much and you're in so many different places. How does that frame your idea of what home is?
I can't tell you how wonderful it is to land at the Cedar Rapids Airport, wherever I'm coming from, and particularly since just the other day I returned from Baghdad. It's a two-day trip back. You begin with a helicopter and then an embassy airplane, and then you overnight in Vienna. It just takes forever. And I got here, and it was so much colder, and I didn't have warm clothes because I'd been in the desert, and I thought, oh, I'm so glad to be cold.
I feel the same way. The air here is wonderful.
Yeah.
And I should say, just because we're living in three places doesn't mean that we don't, in fact, love Iowa City. I loved Iowa City when I came here to be a graduate student, Bob, in 1961, and was happy to come back after I got out of the Army.
Your recent trip to Baghdad, of course, you were visiting with writers in Iraq. How have things changed for those involved in cultural pursuits in Iraq over the last year or two?
Well, what's really interesting is that now we are beginning to approach something like more normal relations between Americans and Iraqis. I think there's a general consensus on both sides that the occupation lasted way too long. There's a general feeling that, okay, it's good that Saddam is gone, but the way that we affected that probably didn't work. But now the violence that you see is mostly Iraqi on Iraqi, and this is a matter of people trying to sort out what this society is going to be all about. So I was there teaching creative writing workshops, meeting with writers. The week before, there was a band there that did some songwriting workshops, and they're working on bringing some film people in the next year. So more normal kinds of activities will happen, and it seemed to me the Iraqis were absolutely eager to get a sense of what Americans are thinking. They feel utterly isolated through the long, nightmarish years of Saddam and the war with Iran and the war with Kuwait and then the sanctions in the 90s and then the long war and occupation by the Americans. And they want to know about the world. And insofar as we can help them with that, that's a good thing.
Do you feel safe when you're in Iraq?
Yeah, well, it's the security precautions that the embassy takes are they're really thorough. The people that I traveled with, they had my back. You feel as safe as you can in a war zone.
How about the people that you are working with? Are they beginning to feel safe? Obviously, living in a place where your physical safety is at risk every single day shapes everything about how you see the world.
Yeah, I think that's the case. When I was dealing with university students, all they've known is either sanctions or war. I remember one young man wrote a piece for me about, he really was saying, how do you write about something when you don't feel anything? And I said, well, why don't you feel anything? And he said, well, his uncle and cousins were all blown up right in front of him. And I thought, oh, okay, so this is what we deal with. And then, so I said, as a writer, we write about not feeling anything. We try to imagine what brought us to that point. We try to create that on the page if we can. And that's the material that young people in all over Iraq will be dealing with. But I just had the sense over and over again, people wanting to get out. They want to visit the United States. They want to get an education here. What do you teach at your university? Questions like that. How can I go and visit this place or that place? They want some part of this world.
So it sounds like the idea of a future is changing.
Exactly.
The idea
now
of what's
possible.
Now there's
a future in which the relationship between Iraq and the United States will be closer to something like a normal relationship between two countries.
Before we run out of time, I want to talk about a new project out of the International Writing Program that is launching this week or last week, really, Whitman Web. Tell me about Whitman Web.
Well, the Whitman Web comes out of the fact that Ed Folsom, the professor in the English department, who is one of the leading scholars in the world on Walt Whitman and who helped to create this amazing archive, the Whitman Archives on the web, we came up with this idea that over the course of a year, we would present the 52 sections of Walt Whitman's most famous poem, Song of Myself, one a week in the original English and in eight other translations, including Chinese, Russian, and the first translation into Persian. We would record it. We got Eric Forsyth from the theater department to record it. We have an Iranian poet recording it in Persian with photographs of Whitman and commentaries written by Ed and me and questions for discussion. And the idea is to start a discussion all around the year, all around the world about this foundational poem for our country.
And who's the audience? Who are you reaching out to around the world?
Well, we hope that we're reaching poets poets and readers in every country, everybody interested in American literature, everybody interested really in the idea of democracy. Whitman's our great poet of the individual, of democracy. And so how did we get from here to there? How did this poet who came of age at a crucial moment in American history just before the Civil War and who bears witness to it in so many different ways. Who is Whitman? That's what we hope to be asking over the course of the year in a lot of different languages.
When you translate something, you know, it's not just changing the words, but especially with a poem, I would think it would be extremely difficult to have a strong translation that not only translates what the words are, but what the poem means. How do you face that challenge? How do you find somebody who can do that?
Well, there are a lot of translations of Whitman. And in fact, in Baghdad, I've been trying to track down a translation of Whitman. And I had been told there was a great one done by an Iraqi poet living in exile. And I got in touch with him, and he said, you can get a copy in Damascus. I said, well, you know, Damascus is a little tough to travel to right now. But in Baghdad, they gave me a copy of it. And then a couple of people came forward and said, oh, you know, there's another translation. It's better than this. And so, you know, that's the business of translation. You're never going to get it right. You hope you get something close. You hope you get something live in the new language. And we mean to put as many of them up as we can.
Marvin, I'll bet you've given this some thought, the idea of poetry traveling around the world. I'm sure many of your poems have been translated as well. How do you think poetry communicates across different languages and across different cultures?
Well, some languages can't be translated into English. You can only create a transliteration. But translators like to have panels and discuss this all the time about whether one should replicate the form of the poem, even if it is difficult to do in English and makes the poem awkward in English. Others believe you translate for the spirit of the poem. The poets Mark Strand and Charles Simic published an anthology of poems in translation by European and South American poets years ago called Another Republic. And they referred to Robert Frost's famous remark that poetry is what is lost in translation. And they argued the opposite. They said, no, poetry is what is retained in translation. Admittedly, that was an anthology of poets who tended to use a plain speech, an accessible speech. And obviously, the more eccentric the poet, the harder it is to translate. But it's worth trying.
Yeah, in fact, in Erbil, I met a woman who's got a whole class devoted to bringing into English Kurdish poems. And we don't really know anything about the Kurds, and except that they don't have a homeland. And by reading some of these poems, I began to get a sense of what the issues are, who the Kurds are. And that's true for every language around the world.
The big deal is to replicate the music somehow, you know. Poetry, as the poet Louis Zukofsky said, in poetry, the lower limit is speech and the upper limit is music. One tries to get as much of the music into the translation as possible.
So when you look at translations, how can you tell, Christopher, what is a good translation and what is not? As you're, I'm assuming you're not fluent in all of these different nine languages that you're putting up the translations of. How do you know what's a good translation and what's not?
Well, I can only speak about translations into English, about their quality. And we teach a translation workshop in the International Writing Program, so this is a question that we address every week. And for us, it's a matter of taste. Does it seem to sing in English? And if not, then what are the reasons why? For translations into other languages, we have to rely on the poets and the readers that we know in those languages to tell us whether in fact the translator has caught the music of the original or not, and recognize that it's a doomed enterprise. And yet we continue to do it because it's in some ways the only hope we have for communication.
Working with writers from all over the world, and in particularly right now, writers from the Middle East in these countries where there has been so much change and there is so much to talk about, and I'm sure that the people within these countries really want to communicate with the rest of the world. Do you find that a lot of the writers that you work with, do they have a desire to be able to write in English so that they can be heard in many other places?
You know, we have that every year. We will have a few writers who want to write in English because that's the lingua franca of the day. That's one part of it, and that's wanting a larger audience. Another version of that, though, is that working with younger writers, Arabic-speaking writers, we have found that many of them want to write in English because the language they've inherited, classical Arabic, which is the Arabic of the Quran, is very difficult to write in. And there's not much literary sanction for writing demotic, colloquial Arabic. So for some writers, particularly younger writers, they find writing in English to be a liberation. So that's something that we are mindful of. But I'm always suggesting to writers, write in your mother tongue. That's where your heart is.
I've interviewed Firouza Dumas, who is an Iranian writer and Iranian-American writer. And when she published her first book called Funny in Farsi, she actually paid out of her own pocket to have a translation done that would be published in Iran because there is so much plagiarism and so much black market publishing that goes on. She wanted to make sure that her book was translated properly and released there. So is that... also a problem that we have this publishing hierarchy, of course, in the United States, but in other countries it just doesn't work the same way.
Well, I remember a translator in Iran approaching me about translating a book, and I said that, you know, that's great, but you'll have to work through my publisher. And she replied that, you know, Iran doesn't follow the copyright law, international copyright law. And I said, well, someday, Iran will re-enter the Common House of Nations, and it would be a good idea for you to begin to practice good publishing standards and obey international law, because that's how we work together around the world. That's something that happened after the fall of the Berlin Wall and the Soviet bloc. You know, things were a little bit slipshod about how copyright would be managed, and that was also true in China. And you know, that's what happens. As we enter a larger global order.
Christopher Merrill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Christopher Merrill is the director of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. And Marvin Bell, thank you so much.
A pleasure.
And travel safely.
Thank you.
Former Iowa Poet Laureate Marvin Bell. They have just produced a collaboration called Everything at Once. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Allison Sullivan. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, we'll get ready for winter with home improvement expert Bill McAnally. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.